But there's so many new niches and creativity and stories to tell in food that there's just, if you really care about the product that you're making and can, like, you teach, tell the story about why that product is important to either you culturally or your family or your community, that resonates with people.
Hey everybody, welcome back. This episode, I think you'll enjoy it because we dive into a world we haven't touched too much on this show, which is the industry of food. I've known Ashley for several years. We started our companies at a similar time and have kind of ran in similar circles. And the thing I love about her business is it's not just something that she looked at as a profitable opportunity. She actually has a story that she's living this out of, that she's building this business out of. She actually cares about what she's doing and has for a long time. And so I think that makes this story really valuable and what she's doing really valuable. And I think also we all just need to be thinking more intentionally about where our food's coming from, how it's getting made, all of that stuff. And what Ashley is doing is making it more possible for things like that to happen. So without further ado, let's get right into it. Welcome to the Small Business Storytellers, the podcast designed for business owners, marketers, and entrepreneurs wanting to make an impact through the work that they do. I'm your host, Seth Silvers, and my passion is building brands that last by marketing with stories. On this podcast, we share stories with you of people who are growing their businesses the right way, and we teach you how to grow what you're doing through storytelling and authentic marketing. Let's get started. Welcome back to the Small Business Storyteller Show. Ashley, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
How do I say your last name?
Colpart.
Colpart.
Exactly how it looks.
Okay, wonderful.
Although some call me Colparty.
Colparty.
If I'm having a party.
Colparty. Cool. I need to join one of those Colparties sometime.
Yeah, they're pretty fun.
Epic. Well, I've known Ashley for 4 years, pretty much since I started StoryOn. We were kind of both in a co-working space. There was a bunch of startups at similar times. When did you officially start the Food Corridor?
So it'll be about 4 years ago. So you're right.
Okay,
it was in June.
Okay, so. I was in June as well. So
whoa,
we have the same birthday. but I'm really happy to have you here today to just talk more about your story and where you guys are at. Cause it's exciting. Also, it's worth noting that you're getting a puppy tomorrow.
I am getting a puppy tomorrow. I'm totally excited, as if I need more responsibility in my life.
No, I think it'll be great. I know I'll have a puppy one day, but I want to prolong that day as long as I can.
And that's what I've done.
Just vicariously live through other people's puppies.
Yeah, the startup is kind of like breathing on its own now, so
right.
I'm like, now I can have a new project. That's keep something else alive.
So, Ashley, to start the conversation, tell us about the Food Corridor.
Okay.
And kind of give us a snapshot of what life looks like for you now and where you're at now, and then we'll go back to really how did it start.
Sure. So the Food Corridor is an online software as a service for shared use kitchens. So shared use meaning a co-working space in the food industry. They're often called commissary kitchens or incubator kitchens. And they're basically where a food entrepreneur can access commercial infrastructure to grow and scale a food business. So common renters in our facilities would be chefs, caterers, food trucks, product manufacturers of CPG products, anyone that's selling direct to consumers in farmers markets or in retail outlets would use these shared commercial spaces, rent time in them to make their local food goods. So our customers are the shared use kitchen operators, so the owners or the managers of these shared facilities. A lot of this has been moving along with the co-working kind mm-hmm. of movement and the sharing economy kind of movement.
Right.
And so the software actually handles the scheduling and booking of the time in the kitchen, compliance for the food business. So we'll document their food handler card, their insurance, and their business license for all the vendors that are using that space, which is actually required by the health department to do. And then we also do all of the billing for those clients. So it's okay. A pretty sophisticated system that manages all of that. And so we're currently in 110 kitchens all over the country, and that represents 8,000 food businesses that are renting from those kitchens.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So initially the need for it is a kind of a match of where if you're going to run a food business, you need to be doing it in a commissary kitchen. You can't be like making stuff at home and then throwing it in a food truck and then selling it at the park.
Well, you're not supposed to do that.
Not supposed to do that. I'm sure absolutely nobody does that.
No one does that.
And I think a lot of people are surprised by that. Like, I mean, we're probably grateful for it, but I think they're surprised like, oh, you need to actually rent a real kitchen. But then you kind of realized, well, there's a lot of commissary kitchens and they might use them during the day or during certain hours and then nobody's using them. So I think it's great how you've kind of brought those together. Rewind back to just like your story growing up. What's the journey been to bring you to this place where you're starting this company to really like help maximize kind of this need and bring together these worlds?
Yeah, it's funny, like my story, it wasn't until I was asked my story that I actually like realized how obvious my journey is and where I am now. So I grew up in food pretty much my whole life. My mom would cater out of our house and was really into food and still does a lot of catering work in Austin, Texas. So I grew up with my mom in Austin, and she actually started a hot sauce company when I was a kid in Austin, which that was actually the first year that they held the Texas Hot Sauce Festival. So this is before there were 10,000 SKUs of hot sauce on the kitchen shelf or on the grocery shelves. It was also right when like Whole Foods started becoming, you know, more prevalent and had started in Austin, Texas. So there was like this timing factor that was going on. My mom would make the hot sauce in our home kitchen. And I remember in the summer times, like jokingly, we would joke about having to wear swim goggles because the peppers that she was making habanero sauce. And that was before anyone actually knew what a habanero pepper was. It was like the hottest pepper on the planet at that time. And so our eyes would be burning when our eyes would be like crying. So we'd be wearing swim goggles to like protect our eyes. But it was a, you know, family owned business. We used to spend weekends getting up really early at the farmer's market, getting to know vendors, selling hot sauce, selling other products that we started making, vinegars and all different kinds of products. And the company was called Sergeant Pepper's Hot Sauce. So, you know, growing up with, you know, as a food entrepreneur, you really see the pain points in kind of that world and where people are coming from and how they're trying to kind of make ends meet with the resources that they have. And again, we used my home kitchen because there wasn't really a commercial kitchen in our community that we could have scaled into. So, another aspect of my story is that my my father was a hardware engineer in the Bay Area during the computer boom. So Silicon Valley time, and he had immigrated here from the Netherlands and was really part of designing the first microprocessor chips for a bunch of startups out in the Bay Area. And
no
so
big deal.
I had no big deal, yeah, MBD. and you know, he talks fondly about those times and how there was just this energy and people were excited, and you know, startups do that for people, and you know, the world was changing in Silicon Valley around that time. So I have, you know, the food entrepreneur half of me, and then I have the technology half of me, and now, you know, I own a food technology company, which, you know, again, telling my story, I'm kind of like, oh, it's more obvious than I ever thought it was.
Right.
Yeah.
So how did you actually get into the entrepreneurship space? Like, were you trying to start things when you were young, or did it come out of school, or what was that journey like for you?
Yeah, so I'm actually a recovering academic. So food was my jam, and I ended up studying my undergrad in nutrition and foods at Texas State University. Ended up moving on and getting my registered dietitian certification. So I was really interested in community dietetics and the reasons why people eat the foods that they eat. So my first job out in Austin was as the nutrition services coordinator for Meals on Wheels. So I ran a program called Meals for Kids, where we were providing a nutritious meal for kids in housing developments. And then my role was doing nutrition education with the kids. So I got to design the meals and then go into these housing developments and teach these kids, different lessons on nutrition and why, you know, how to eat healthy foods and why it's important to their lives. And so that was really impactful. But I was really still itching as to like why why are these kids having to, you know, what situational issues lead to the access points for food for these kids specifically? And why is that different for other people? And, you know, for like nutrition programs, how they're based on the USDA guidelines and how like meal reimbursement works. It's all kind of technical food policy stuff. But I ended up going on and getting a master's in food policy and applied nutrition from Tufts University in Boston. And that's where I started getting a kind of a more macro lens on the food system and really interested in local and regional food systems.
Right.
So I studied sustainable food systems and the environment as my specialty and started learning like about agriculture and why farmers grow the food that they grow and how subsidies impact what farmers grow and how the distribution works and again leading into access for humans. So just really kind of looking at the whole landscape of the food system and how we grow, produce, manufacture, distribute and consume food, and how if you pull on one lever of that system, it impacts another part of the system. So there's not really any easy solutions for creating more sustainable regional food systems. Really have to kind of take all those factors into mind. So I ended up in going back to Texas and teaching food systems at Texas State for a year, where I kind of figured out what I wanted to do. And decided to get a PhD because I was just still very much, you know, focused on local regional food system development,
right,
and specifically on economic development. How can we create more regional capacity? And around that time, you know, the sharing economy was starting to kind of come online, and I was becoming a bit obsessed with like underutilized assets, and like, you know, people were using, you know, cars and using all these different underutilized assets that are kind of being leveraged. They're finding
slack. And were
you
in the Northeast at that time?
So I was in Boston. Okay. After I left Boston, actually, I kind of skipped a part of the journey, but I went out to San Diego.
Okay.
And I became the farm to institution coordinator for the county. So I was aggregating.
You were in like big cities where like this shared economy was kind of like getting kickstarted.
Yeah,
you were seeing
exactly.
It happen.
I was seeing it happen. Yeah. I got the idea for, so I started doing my PhD and I was working on this one project that, you know, was kind of spinning my wheels a bit. I was not too excited about it. But when that sharing economy stuff started happening, I started getting excited about that. And I had gone out to DC and I took Uber for the first time, and this is actually like my magic moment.
The magic moment.
I was out in DC, and I was on a panel for some big grants that USDA provides to communities called Community Food Project Grants. And as a, you know, a steward of public funds, I was responsible for like identifying which one of these projects that we need to fund as a country. And I took that very seriously. You know, that's taxpayers' money. So you
want
to like put good money to use and not throw good money at bad. And many of the projects wanted to build infrastructure. So they were wanting to build these huge facilities, these processing facilities and storage facilities for local food. And so I took Uber for the first time that same weekend. And when I was kind of feeling conflicted about that, and I was kind of like, underutilized assets, like there's something here. How can we apply that concept to the food space? And is anyone doing that? And so I came back kind of obsessed with the topic. I started thinking, like, I remember writing the idea down for Airbnb for commercial kitchens and kind of drawing out this picture. And then I went to Innisphere and I met with some folks that kind of like were like, you should actually do this. And I like showed them this picture. It was like Maggie and Doug Johnson.
Yeah, totally.
And I went to have drinks with them and they're like, you totally should do this. I still have that picture, actually.
That's amazing.
The first version of Food Corridor.
You should frame it.
I really should. And then I also wrote, I remember, I read, like, if I didn't want anyone to steal my idea, how did I do that? So I wrote, like, a certified mail to myself with the idea in it, and I mailed it to myself. So it's, like, still, like, closed right now.
Interesting.
So I'm protecting my idea.
That's amazing. I don't think many people would think of doing that.
Yeah, I think I read it online somewhere as, like, what I was supposed to have done.
Do you have some other, like, other important things in your life that you've, like, mailed to yourself via certified mail, or is that the only one?
That was the only time. Okay. Yeah, still a very bizarre thing to do. So I came back, and I remember I saw it, like, through Facebook. There was, like, this startup week for Collins, and I was like, what is that? Like, what does that even mean? It's like, am I starting up? Like,
was this when it was still run by Chris?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, and that was that startup week. I think it was May of 2015.
I think that sounds right to me.
Yeah, and I was like, I was still working my job. I had just in April told my employers, like, hey, I'm doing this. I'm starting my own business, and so like, what's the best way to transition out? And so I worked with them for another 3 or 4 months, but I was like, I need this week off to go to startup week. And yeah. I remember that week very vividly.
I remember like riding my bike down to startup week and like having no idea what I was getting myself into, but feeling like something was calling me there. Hmm. It was so bizarre. And then I remember going in, there was like this event going on with all these booths, and I was going by all these booths, like talking to like legal people and all this stuff. And I went over to the lawyer guy. He was a patent lawyer, Russ. Do you know Russ?
Yeah.
So I was talking to Russ and I was like, I'm scared to tell anybody my idea. And he was like, rolled his eyes. He was like, no, it's going to steal your idea. Like, it's so hard to start a company. Like, even if you told everyone, like, you know, no one's going to steal your idea. He actually told me the opposite. He was like, you need to tell everyone your idea and get their feedback. And he was like, you know what you need to do is talk to 100 people that are in your space about your idea and get their feedback.
That's great.
And I did that. I like literally kept a spreadsheet of 100 people and I wrote notes on every person that I talked to. I reached out to everyone in my local food networks, everyone. I was like, I have this idea. What do you think?
What did you discover from that?
I discovered like quite a bit of validation around like, that's a really good idea. I discovered some of the legal ramifications or the legal hurdles that I would be facing around like local health departments versus, you know, FDA versus state, like all the different regulatory bodies that oversee food and how it would be really difficult for a food business to just be able to jump from one kitchen to the other because they actually can't just do that. They have to have a longer kind of relationship with that kitchen and be licensed under that specific facility. So the idea of it just being that open sharing economy where you can just book it at any time wouldn't actually work for Food Corridor. So that was a really interesting learning. Yeah, those were kind of the two big ones. And then I was kind of like, I need to watch out for this.
So that was kind of your accidental market validation, like market research. And I'm sure, I'm sure you'd like read stuff about like how to start it, like Google, how to start a business and all of this stuff.
Yeah.
But I love that you kind of like stumbled into this really amazing, like everybody should probably do that. That's a brilliant idea. I imagine there was like a first kitchen that like signed on and it was kind of like a test, like, okay, let's try and make this work.
So remember, I was an academic. So at this time I was working on my PhD at CSU.
Okay.
So I took actually a overly academic approach to starting my company, like textbook almost. So, and literally almost. So, cause I had to write the book it's sitting on my shelf at home. My dissertation.
That's amazing.
So I came back from DC obsessed about this idea, and I convinced my committee to let me change my topic altogether, even though I had for 3 years been working on this one project, and they looked at me like, you are crazy. But I told them if they didn't let me change my project, I would actually never finish my dissertation because I was so uninspired by the topic I was currently doing. Hmm. So I actually told them the opposite. I said, if you don't let me change my topic, I will never finish. So what I ended up doing is making my market validation my dissertation research.
Okay.
So I surveyed 140 shared use kitchens across the country. Shared use, again, being where their business models to rent out to multiple tenants. So that was part of my survey. I surveyed similarly 300 food businesses on how they access space and what their constraints are. And then I ran a pilot. And this is kind of the first kitchen sort of thing where I brought on 4 different types of kitchens. So I had a church kitchen, I had a school district kitchen, I had a bakery, I had a traditional commissary. And then I think I had a restaurant that was closed, you know, during certain hours that was willing to rent out their space.
Okay.
And so I basically did like kind of the lean startup methodology where I threw up, I had intake forms for the kitchens to fill out on like what kind of renters they were looking for, what times were available, what documents they would need in order to actually facilitate a relationship. So I got them all onboarded. So I had the supply of kitchens there. And then I needed like the demand of food businesses. So around that time, I was working kind of closely with a lot of the food network folks in Northern Colorado. And I was able to kind of leverage that community and the Farmers Market Association and stuff. So I threw up a form online, like looking for shared kitchen space in Colorado. And a lot, some of my partners were able to like put it in their newsletter and stuff. Cool. And by the end of the week, I had 52 food businesses fill out the form looking for space.
That's awesome.
And so I manually matched those food businesses with the spaces, introduced them to the kitchens. I went and recorded their interviews so I can learn like what they would ask each other, and really just documented like all of the notes, and then wrote case studies for everyone on following up. So a lot of them were able to actually get placed in those kitchens and rent from those kitchens.
Wow.
And and then so I wrote up different case studies for all of those, and that ended up becoming a big part of my dissertation research as well, which led obviously into launching the company.
Right.
Weird.
What has traction like looked like over the last 4 years? Like, you know, that's kind of like the first few months and stuff, and figuring all of that out.
Yeah.
Kind of give us an overview of like what has these 4 years looked like? Because most startups, especially like tech startups, don't make it 4 years.
Yeah.
I feel like there's also some assumptions that like, oh, cool, you're 4 years in, like, are you guys ready to sell for $150 million? Yeah. Like, just like, give us a picture.
If anyone's listening. Yeah,
if anybody wants to buy.
Yeah, that's the price tag.
But yeah, like what's the 4 years looked like?
Yeah. So around that time decided to bring on a tech co-founder, because I had enough like proof of concept and had done enough of the work that I think I could convince a developer to kind of come on board with me as a partner to kind of build out the first version of the product.
Because you were just kind of matching it manually at that point. So you were wanting to actually build the product.
Yeah, exactly. And I think in order to convince an engineer to come on board, they want to see that there's actually a there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was able to kind of do that with my tech co-founder, Dan, who was amazing. He also had a huge passion for what I was doing, and really he was passionate about local food. So he had the why as well.
Right.
So we were great partners early on. He helped build out the whole first version of Food Corridor. We beta tested with 13 kitchens from our community. So I also at that same time launched a community called the Network for Incubator and Commissary Kitchens. That was based out of my survey that I had done. I had an open-ended question at the end of the survey, and a bunch of the kitchens from across the country were like, where do I go to ask people questions? And I wish there was a forum where we could talk to each other. And I was kind of like, oh my God, why doesn't that exist?
Yeah.
That seems like low hanging fruit. So I created this online community to kind of pull all those folks together and let them talk to each other. So we took 13 of those folks that committed to beta testing with us, and we built version one to try to address their pain points like head on. And of those 13, we ended up onboarding 8. So it took us about 2.5 to 3 months to build the software, and they beta tested through that. And in exchange, we gave them Friend of the Food Corridor rates for life. And they're still on our platform. They're our first customers. They're our heroes, essentially. Because I look back at the product now and where it is today, and I'm kind of like, I can't believe these people actually came on board with us. Like, they must have been feeling the pain, because version one, is pretty funny to look back at.
It's so I feel like that's true with almost anything, though, whether it's like, for us, it's usually more media. Like, you look back and you're like, we thought that video looked good.
But
at the time, it's like you're responding to the context that you have. And so it's like, wow, this is great. And then things get better and better.
Well, I mean, comparing it to me manually doing it, I was like, this is the jam. This is amazing that an engineer could build this for us, and it actually is something. So that was pretty cool for me to visualize and see it coming to life. So then, that went on. We beta tested again and brought on 8 of the kitchens of the 13. And then we just started, selling and iterating. So we were, bringing on more kitchens, adding more features, iterating on the features we had, growing the brand, growing the community. We just started rolling with it. And, sales stayed steady. We just every month had continued month on month growth. And it went really, it was going pretty well, to the point where we decided it was time to raise a little capital. So we raised a small seed round, which closed in January of 2018. So we raised about $500,000 with some really amazing investors here in Colorado that have been super supportive of our journey. That obviously gave us a little cash to kind of take the platform to the next level. Around that time, Dan, my tech co-founder, moved on to bigger and better worlds and more hefty paychecks for his family in Boulder. He's still a great friend and advisor of the company. Cool. But we brought on an external product team that kind of did a complete overhaul of the product, kind of version two of the product. So, you know, the front end got completely UX UI'd, if that's a word.
We know what you're talking about.
That's good. And kind of brought it into a more modern viewpoint. And then we just continued with the sales and the marketing side of things. Doing projects, we partnered with Purdue University to create a toolkit for shared kitchens on how to start one of these kitchens in your community. Speaking at conferences and growing the, you know, the community and kind of becoming a thought leader in the space. Our strategic goals for the last couple of years have been continue to grow the SaaS platform and bring on as many kitchens as we can to bring that value to them. But then also build the community and build the thought leadership and build resources for this emerging community, because there's a lot of green space there and no one was really doing that. And I just felt like it was our calling. It was just, you know, all of the thinking that I had put into this, and all of the work I had done, you know, was one thing. But I also think that for me, you know, people talk about the why. Like, why are you doing what you're doing? And for me, it's always been about local and regional food systems. Like, how can I contribute in a meaningful way to economic development in a local and regional food system? And in academia, you can research those things and you can, you know, hypothesize about those things. But in business, you can actually do those things. And I'm a very applied person. So I can take a academic approach and then apply that in the real world. And that to me has just been like the merging of both things and being able to kind of see out our mission and vision to enable efficiency, growth, and innovation in local food. So
that's awesome.
Doing it all.
Why does local and regional food sourcing, like, why is that important? I don't think anybody would say that they want preservatives in their food and that they want crappy supply chains and all of this stuff. Yeah. But I don't feel like we really know, like, the weight of it. So why, and I'm really glad you mentioned that, like, that's still kind of the why behind what you're doing. But why is that important and why should it be more important to us?
Yeah, so I think, you know, as we're entering a world or have been in, you know, living in a world that becomes more erratic and existential, you know, external impacts to our livelihood. So climate change, war, poverty, weather, all of these like external things. Well, poverty is not external, it's actually internal, but you know, a lot of these things can have huge impacts on our food supply chain. And that potentially could lead to hunger and food insecurity for a community, which is the lifeblood of a community. And so, you know, that's obviously a huge reason why, you know, sourcing your food locally can prevent those impacts. So if you're importing, you know, 100% of your food and there's a big global shock to the system, you know, think about what that is going to do to a community.
Right.
It's a scary thing to think about, but it's a reality.
Is it possible for me to actually have everything I need from Northern Colorado?
So is it possible? Maybe. Is it, if you only want to eat a couple things?
Yeah. So like speak to that aspect of like, where is like an advanced supply chain where we're importing and doing all this stuff? Like, where is that valuable and where is it going too far to where it's actually like, I imagine it's kind of like a curve where it's like beneficial. And then at some point it becomes like we've gone too far and it's not beneficial. And it's actually harming us. Help us understand that.
So I actually think the real value is in eating seasonally, like what can grow well, where you are locally and what's supposed to grow there. Those are things that you should be eating in the seasons that they are bountiful. Hmm. So, you know, Colorado has a shorter growing season. So there's things that we can eat in the spring and the summer that obviously we shouldn't be eating in the fall or the winter as much. And those are, you know, and then we can trade them for either canned versions or lightly processed versions of them, value added versions of those. But you know, I'm not a purist on this at all. I mean, I drink coffee, I eat chocolate, I eat canned artichokes, because if you've ever tried to like make artichokes yourself. It's one of the most laborious things ever. Same with canned pumpkin. I love canned pumpkin, because have you ever tried to make pumpkin pie from scratch? Like,
I have not.
It is rough. It is a lot of work. So, I mean, I think that there are foods that are, you know, a lightly processed that should be part of our diets. And I'm not a purist by any means, but I think that, you know, there's the shocks to the system. So having outlets for food and making sure that we have that some of that infrastructure in place instead mm-hmm. of letting all of the local farms go away is really important. So supporting local agriculture, I think, is important for all communities. And then, you know, the value added products and the food infrastructure. So, you know, it might not just be farmers, but it's also folks that are processing those products into other products. And then those retailers that are selling those local products. And then there's the restaurants that are sourcing some of those local right. products. And, you know, it's a whole system, and that there's different places that you can contribute to the local food economy, not just going direct to a farmer, but in all of those different downstream parts of it. And then, if you think about kind of the question you were asking about as the why, is like that creates economic development that then stays in the community. Those are jobs for people that live in the community, and all of that kind of feedback mechanisms that come from building a vibrant economy. So a vibrant economy from food is just one part of a vibrant economy, but there's so much potential still mm-hmm. for those types of jobs. They're, you know, they're great like immigrant populations that come with their recipes from home that could be starting like a really cool food truck or opening a restaurant in a community. It just, mm-hmm. there's so much power in food. There's so much, power and freedom in food.
Did you pick up on some of that when you were like young with your goggles on handling chili peppers and stuff? Like how, I guess now looking back on your story, can you see these things that you began to learn that are now impacting, like now that you're actually doing it, you're actually like making an impact based on like the passion that you have. What do you see that you like picked up as a young girl at farmers markets?
I think sales is a lot of them. Like, you know, my mom had me at that front table. There's photos of me and my brother selling hot sauce at the farmer's market. Right. So sales is one. And I think, you know, when you're a kid selling it, it's like, you're like, do you want to try our hot sauce? You know, it's like kind of obnoxious. But but what we're showing there is like, this is a family-owned business, and that like we are the kids that are, you know, benefiting from you buying this hot sauce from us. It's a family kind of business. I think that's a big part of it, is like each of these and the story that the products tell and the story that the family tells, and that, you know, there's just those community connections. I think I hear and see stories like that from clients, in the renters of our clients all the time, and it's just it's beautiful that there are new, that the barriers to entry are so much lower than they have ever been, and the opportunities for starting a food business are easier than they've ever been in a lot of ways. More complicated, because you know people expect high quality, low cost, all those kind of things. Yeah. But there's so many new niches and creativity and stories to tell in food that there's just, if you really care about the product that you're making and can, like you teach, tell the story about why that product is important to either you culturally or your family or your community, that resonates with people.
So we, from the kitchen's perspective, we've been able to see kitchens grow there. So there, kitchens can be way more efficient when they utilize our software. So what that means is some of our case studies that we've run on our kitchens is that, you know, where they used to only be able to manage 10 renters, they now can have 20, 25, 30, 50 renters. And so the impact that those kitchens are having on having so many more people being able to access their facility, and that's just that many more food businesses that are in that, like, said community.
Right.
So we really see that. I don't know anyone like any super like specific one. One of the things we do is keep a list of the food businesses' names that we really like, that are like kind of play on words and tongue in cheek. That's pretty fun. I'll have to pull some of them up because I can't think of them right now. That's like one of the fun things we like to do.
I love it. So most people know that like if you want to start a successful business, you should not start a tech company, because most people just fail, or they can't find funding, or they think they have a great idea and they don't. And
yeah.
It's just, it's a hard space to jump into, as is the food industry. So what have been some of the challenges and just like roadblocks that you feel like you've ran into over the last 4 years? And has there been a time where you've kind of wondered to yourself, like, eh, is this going to work? Or was this maybe just a cool idea for 2 years?
Oh, I think that every day. I mean, it's still, you know, it always feels really fragile. Like, because, you know, again, when I think about like the large market trends and what's happening in the industry, especially for us right now with like the advent of cloud kitchens and ghost kitchens, which are essentially delivery only restaurants that are looking for access to these commercial spaces. But a lot of the big players are starting to get into the industry. So the Uber Eats of the world and the DoorDashes of the world and the Deliveroos of the world, they're all starting to get into commercial kitchens. So I'm always kind of like, hey, I thought this was my space and no one was in it. And all of a sudden it's becoming kind of mainstream. So that's a little interesting. Like I said, it's always fragile. And I always have, you know, I still have those moments where I like wake up in the middle of the night and I'm like freaking out. Like, oh my God, what if tomorrow, like it all goes away or all our clients email us and are like, I'm offboarding, or you just never know. It's just very, fragile. What was the question?
I just say, I'm always curious, like if people are, about throwing in the towel and it overcame that, but then also just, what have been some of the challenges you guys have faced?
Yeah. So the throwing in the towel question, maybe once in a while, you know, but it's normally on a day where I just feel beaten down and my energy's low and I didn't eat right and maybe I didn't sleep right. And I'm just kind of like having one of those days where it feels like everything in the world is just like a negative, like, version of it, you know?
I find most businesses that stay in business, I think every business owner has very, very strong memories of like those what I call like those days. Yeah. And when I'm thinking to myself, like, oh, these are the days when like people quit. Like, these are the days when like whatever happens. Yeah, these are the days when like the statistics become real, because it feels like it'd be so much easier to just go get a job and quit and do whatever. But then
mostly when it's like an interpersonal thing, like when it's one of our clients that like is super upset, like I take that really to heart and personally, because I really am doing this to bring them value. And when they're frustrated or something's not working. So we basically, like last month, we rebuilt our back end, like our whole billing system, and we've been releasing it like slowly. And it's a complex system on the back end and it impacts everything on the front end. It's like spaghetti back there and everything's connected to something else. So, you know, we tried with our quality assurance before we did any releases to make sure we had thought of everything and everything was there. But, you know, we didn't have product parity for a week and we didn't, like, people were, you know, really upset, like, where's this button? I need to be able to do X, and you know, just really frustrated. And you know, we actually accidentally got CC'd on an email, like an internal email, like, this isn't working for us, we need to find another option. And it was like all of their, you know, decision makers. And I was like, oh my God. So all that did for me is I reached out directly to them and I was like, I'm so sorry. Like, here's where we're at. This is what's going on. I'm going to give you a month free, please, you know, bear with us. And I ended up writing that same version of that letter to all of our clients after that. Cause I was like, if this one client's feeling this, and but we can't see it, there's probably others that also are feeling that way. So I just wrote a direct letter to everyone from the CEO, just putting my heart on the line and being like, I get you're frustrated right now, so are we. Like, we are doing the best we can with what we have. We're trying to make it better in the long term and make it, you know, faster for you. And, you know, this is all in your interest. So please just bear with us. Yeah. And it ended up, you know, the feedback we got from those emails were just like, we're with you, no big deal, we love you guys. Like, you know, 99% were like that. But that one, you get that one email and it's like, your heart's racing and you're just like freaking out because it's important to you.
Yeah. You mentioned before, kind of the aspect of like growth for you as an entrepreneur and how you find like people that can support you and people you can learn from. And like, you know, Fort Collins is a growing like tech space, but it's like kind of like a little brother to like Boulder and Denver and some other communities, even though Colorado is booming business wise. So how have you like been poured into, and is, do you see that as like a challenge to like, as you're continuing to grow, to find the right people to be able to pour into you?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, here in Fort Collins, like I've been asked to speak on, you know, panels at Startup Week and, you know, investor forums for RVC, you know, cause I'm a RVC Ventures invested in us. And, you know, I volunteer for that stuff and try to be on panels and contribute in every way I can. But sometimes I'm up there like, why do they want me on this panel? Like, I don't know what I'm doing.
You
know?
I need a panel. Talk to me.
It's like, where's my panel I can go to about what I'm supposed to be doing? But yeah, that's a good point. So I, for instance, have a mastermind group, and it's all female founders here in Fort Collins, and really like super supportive and great group. But they're, the girls in the group are, you know, a few years behind where I am at this point. And so I tend to add a ton of value and talk a lot and try to contribute to them. And they do provide a lot of support for me, but it's just the space that I'm in and the time that I am in my company is very different than where they are. And so I'm actually kind of struggling trying to find that, like, you know, like, what do they say? If you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room kind of thing.
Yeah.
I like that thought experiment about, like, who am I surrounding myself with that are going to challenge me and take me to the next level as an operator and as a CEO so that I can help take the food corridor into the next phase. Because we've started up. Like, we're good. Like, we have month-to-month recurring revenue. We have clients. We're growing. We're doing a lot of things right. But it's really kind of that, all right, so what next?
Yeah, you're probably not really considered a startup anymore. Like,
yeah.
I mean,
which, Seth, we need to find out a term for, like, the in between. Like, there needs, what's the step down version of a startup? Like, the next,
know.
What do we, I'm a company? It's like, that is too boring. And I don't not feel that secure. I'm a company.
Funny.
I like startup because it's got that energy behind it, that
yeah.
pizzazz. It's kind of sexy.
Yeah, it's, I feel like every word comes with like baggage. Some is good, some is bad and whatnot. So I think in a lot of ways, it's probably good that you're out of that phase of being called like a startup, but because I think it like communicates some, like, you know, being established and different things. But yeah, we need to come up with a word.
Let's work on that.
What's been helpful for you as far as like resources, or you mentioned a mastermind and stuff, just
yeah.
like what has helped you to just keep moving forward more on like an individual basis as a business owner?
Yeah, so I seek out mentorship pretty often, quick and often. So some even advisors I've kind of grown out of that have helped me with the early stages. So I seek out new advisors as I grow and change. Right now I'm looking for an executive coach because I feel like that would really help me just have those powerful discussions or with myself that I need to be having. So that's important and something I'm going to be doing more of. My advisors and my investors are always available to me and have been so great and really championed me. One thing that I do that's been probably a cornerstone to my success is when I first started the company, I started a monthly update, and I pretty much in the beginning invited anyone that was willing to listen to my monthly update. So if I was in a pitch competition, I invited all the judges. If I was, you know, pitching to investors, I invited all the investors. I tried to get
the moan and groan.
Yeah, I call it brag and moan.
Brag and moan.
Brag
I was like,
and moan.
I was thinking about, I was like, moan and groan. I was like, that's two negatives. There's gotta be a pot.
Yeah.
Brag
sometimes it feels like a moan and groan. But no, I got into this cadence with myself. Where I would do this monthly update, and it really, as an operator, allows me to pull all the metrics and all the things that are going on across the business into one place every month. And so I do it for them and the community I've built, and to kind of make sure I'm holding myself accountable to that community.
Right.
But it also has helped me tremendously, like, see those trends over time and make sure that we are continuing to have upward and forward momentum with things.
Right.
And if I say next month we're doing X, Y, and Z, you know, you better bet that I'm having X, Y, and Z as the things that we've accomplished for that month, because I, you know, assume that this community is holding me accountable.
Yeah.
Even if they're probably not, like, looking at it that carefully,
yeah.
It's still important to me to kind of put that out there. And if I'm going to put that out there and hold myself accountable, then I'm actually going to achieve those things.
Yeah.
And so that's really helped me kind of just, like, keep moving forward. And
have you seen a pretty strong connection between like how Ashley's doing and how the business is doing? Not necessarily just like a good day or a bad day, but like how connected is Ashley's personal development to the growth of the business and the development, like the health?
That's a really interesting question, Seth. So starting Food Corridor has been like the best adventure of my life. And I feel kind of, I don't want to say lucky or fortunate, because I feel like I put a lot of thought into doing this, and it's not just a kind of, I got lucky. But I still have that every day that I get up is exciting. And I love my team, and I love our clients, and I love our industry. And I just feel like it has brought stuff out of me that I didn't even know was in there and challenged me. And so I feel like I've grown my, like, professionally just alongside of it. Like, it is me. Like, I live and breathe Food Corridor, and it is very reflection of me. So it's interesting that you even say that, but we've been fortunate also to have like pretty steady growth, and I feel like I've had that similar steady growth where I'm challenging myself, I'm pushing the limits, I'm getting out of my comfort zone quite often, and I feel like the company is also kind of at the same time doing that. I hadn't really thought of it that way, but it's kind of beautiful.
Yeah, I've seen that. I feel like a lot of the ways my business has helped back is often connected to like my own fears or insecurities, mm-hmm. or like how much I'm executing on things and stuff.
Yeah.
And I just think it's often overlooked, like how connected business growth or development is to like our lives as business owners and whatnot.
Yeah. And taking risks as well. I mean, you know, people can be risk averse, but this is not an industry for people that are risk averse, and if you are, you really have to push yourself to not be, because you have to throw things at the wall and see what sticks, and you have to test things a lot and iterate and change and pivot really fast and make decisions really quickly. And I think I'm pretty good at that, but like I actually, Seamus Nally and I started doing one-on-ones, and he is really great about pushing me and getting me to think about stuff I wasn't thinking about. And he's like, you're too comfortable. Like, what about this? You need to try this. Or like, you know, what if you had all the money in the world, what would you be doing? Or what if next month you had 20% month-on-month growth this month, what if next month's like negative 50? What are you going to do then? Like, what's your plan? And I was like, well, I hadn't really thought about that because that's not going to happen. And he's like, well, you know, so I appreciate, you know, his candidness, A, and B, just his willingness to kind of push me, continue to push me, because I think that the company pushes you, but you also need, you know, need others to kind of help kind of prod you along as well.
Yeah. Do you feel like you will always be beating the drum of this like local and regional food conversation? I don't even know the right terms because it's not my world, but like is this passion of like local food and like more healthy and more sustainable supply chains, like, is this a drum you feel like you'll always be beating, whether it's with Food Corridor or not?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's important, and I don't think it's going to go away as being important.
Yeah.
So I think it's also so part of my DNA now. I mean, I've spent all of my you know, academic career studying it and understanding it inside and out, and surrounding myself with the players in the industry.
Right.
And you know, it's a small world after all, so I've kind of become a leader in it at this point, just through sheer passion and grit. But yeah, I do. But I also see myself, like, you know, when I think about like what's next for Food Corridor, or like, you know, you have the option, are you going to raise more money? Are you going to raise your Series A? Are you going to just, you know, continue to grow at the state you're growing in, break even by X date? Are you going to get acquired and sell to DoorDash? Like, you know, who knows?
Mm-hmm.
There's all those paths could potentially be there. I like to say that I like to spin plates, like keeping all of those plates spinning at the same time, because you never know which path's actually going to be the
right
one that makes itself more obvious to
yeah.
you at this point. So, you know, I've had the question people ask, like, well, if you sell to a company and then the vision mission changes, what are you going to do? And it's like, what am I not going to do? I'll start my next company.
Yeah.
I'll start mentoring other female founders. I'll start angel investing in other female founders, which I would love to do. I also, like, would love to do, like, professional poker playing. Like, there's plenty of things, plenty of other things that I'll be doing.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you know, local food is always going to be part of my world. I'll always have a CSA with my local farmer and always just be keeping my finger on the pulse of that industry. A lot changing in it right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, with like cellular agriculture and the plant protein movement, and just like really there's so much happening in that space that's very different from when I got my master's and my PhD. It's like right. Completely different world. So staying up to snuff on all of it is a chore and a good one.
It'll be fun to see where your journey takes you. Two last questions. One, for people like wanting to, I guess, be more connected to like local agriculture, wanting to do more local food, and I guess just be like experience food in a more healthy way for the planet, like what would be some like initial recommendations or like steps people could take where this is like a totally new thing? They've just been eating off the shelf, whatever comes to them.
Yeah.
What would you say?
I would say, plan to go to your local farmer's market on Saturday morning and just go walk around and check things out, see what grows in your area in the season. Go talk to a couple of farmers and just ask them, like, what's life like? What are you up to? What are you growing here? Just ask questions, be curious. Farmers love to talk about their stories and and their challenges, probably more their challenges than their stories. But it's great. And then you probably have local farms near you that you can support. There's a really cool business model called Community Supported Agriculture, or a CSA. It's essentially kind of like a subscription in SaaS, I guess. But you prepay a certain amount at the beginning of the season, which allows you to kind of take out risk along with the farmer. And then that farmer uses it to buy their seed and their fertilizer and their equipment. It kind of gives them it helps the community support those upfront costs for that farmer so that they can then grow their crops for the year. And then in what you get back from that is a box every week of local seasonal produce from that farm. So that's a really great way to just kind of have a connection with the local farm and make sure that place-based agriculture remains in your community. Eating at farm-to-table restaurants that are supporting those folks, looking for the local Colorado-grown or Colorado-proud. Here in Colorado, but every state has a marketing campaign for how to support those local initiatives across the country. And another one, local co-ops. So cooperatively owned grocery stores are amazing, and you can become a member of that grocery store and actually be a partial owner of that grocery store and sit on the board and participate in that grocery store. Those are typically the cornerstones of the local food economy, and they do a lot of local sourcing. So
that's cool.
Go walk around your co-op, get to know the people there, maybe become a member or at least shop there once in a while.
Yeah.
It'd be great. Those are all things that are,
There's so many opportunities. I feel like people think that it's harder than it probably is.
Just eat seasonally. I think if you want the lowest hanging fruit, it's like, don't eat strawberries in the winter, eat them in the summer when they taste amazing anyway.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
And last but not least, most of the people listening to this are starters of something, or future starters, or business owners, entrepreneurs. What would your advice be to other business owners out there that are going through the highs and lows of the business world?
Yeah. So I have two things that I carry with me. One is, don't let perfection be the enemy of the good. So I think with our business, it typically is an extension of us, and we want everything to be perfect when we show it to the world. But you can't do that with business and startups. You have to put something out there and then get feedback and then iterate. So sometimes that can be really uncomfortable, whether that's a piece of content or whether that's a podcast episode that you just recorded for the first time, or it's the first version of your product. Just get it in people's hands and start getting feedback and have thick skin about it, because you don't want to hear it's great. You want to hear what's wrong with it, because if someone's willing to tell you that, that's the most valuable information that you're going to get, is that candid information of what people really think about what you're doing. So take that to heart and appreciate people when they're willing to give it to you. Don't feel bad about it or get mad at them. And then the other really big one that I like to think about in business is solve real world problems. Like, a lot of the best companies come from people scratching their own itch. It's like, God, I wish there was a da-da-da to do da-da-da for me. It's like, if you have that itch, it's most likely other people have that itch. And if you can create an elegant solution for that itch, that those are the best companies. That's where they come from. So think about, you know, the pain points in your own life and that, and a group of people that might have similar pain points, and then start talking to them and you know, collecting information and data and try to keep it, you know, I want to say over, you know, people tease me because I'm an academic, but I think the first stages of starting a company is all research, and you have to be a good researcher and get that feedback from people. So surveys and all that kind of stuff. So be willing to talk to people and get out of the office and into the communities that you're trying to serve.
That's awesome. I love that. I hope somebody that's listening talks to 100 people.
Yeah. Keep a spreadsheet, send it to me.
Yeah.
Write a blog post about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story. Absolutely. And I'm excited to watch the Food Corridor, to continue reading the Brag and Moans and just see the journey continue to grow. And it'll be fun to see where that takes you personally. But I appreciate you coming in today. Thanks for sharing your story.
Thanks for the great questions. And yeah, thanks for having me. This has been fun.
Great. Thanks.
This podcast was produced by Storyon Media and Marketing, and our passion is helping small businesses use stories to grow their business, and we create a community that helps you do just that. So if you don't have the budget to hire a big agency, but you really want to learn how to navigate online marketing, how to tell better stories, and really how to build a brand that lasts, then our program, Success with Stories Elite, is for you. Every single week, we give you new trainings, content ideas, and content blueprints to make marketing with stories easy. To join our community, head over to www.successwithstories.com/elite, or just click on the link in our show notes. Again, that's successwithstories.com/elite. Have an awesome day, and let us know what you loved about this episode by leaving a review on iTunes or your favorite podcasting platform. Thank you so much. My name is Seth Silvers, and I will see you next time.